with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Look for a high of 88. The wind will be light and from the northwest. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low of 64 and a light northeast wind. Thursday, mostly sunny with a high in the mid-80s and a northeast wind from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Thursday night and Friday, partly cloudy with a low Friday night in the mid-60s and a high Friday in the mid-80s. Friday night, mostly clear with a low in the mid-60s. And I made a typo in the forecast for Thursday night. Partly cloudy Thursday night and Friday, partly cloudy with a low Thursday night in the mid-60s and a high Friday in the mid-80s, and Friday night mostly clear with a low in the mid-60s. At noon Central Time, sunshine prevailed over Illinois and Indiana with temperatures in the 80s. At Rockford, it was 87. At O'Hare, 86. Peoria, 84. Mattoon, 82. Carbondale, 86. At South Bend, 84. Lafayette, 82. Indianapolis reported 86. And Terre Haute checked in with 83 degrees. Willard Airport at the top of the hour reported 81 degrees. The sky sunny. The dew point 60. The relative humidity 48%. The wind calm. And the barometric pressure 30.04 and rising. And at 12:39 Central Time, 85 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. From 1933 through the mid-40s, Hank Greenberg anchored first base for the Detroit Tigers, leading the team twice to the World Series. But the slugger dealt with constant berating from fans because of his Jewish faith.
I found that it was the spur to make me do better, because I could never fall asleep on a ball field. You know, as soon as you struck out, you know, you were not only a bum, but you were a Jewish bum.
That's the late Hall of Famer, profiled in a 1998 documentary. Greenberg once rivaled Babe Ruth for the single-season home run mark, but it was his role off the field and choosing not to play on one of the Jewish High Holy Days that inspired a legion of fans. A new book profiles Greenberg's life and career, as well as a label that stuck, whether he wanted it or not. Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert spoke with author Mark Kurlansky, author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero Who Didn't Want to Be One.
One of the things that struck me almost immediately when I started researching the book is how different the real Hank Greenberg was from the popular image, and that he, in fact, was in a lot of ways like my parents. You know, he was typical of his generation. In fact, my mother came from the same neighborhood in the Bronx. You know, he was the son of Jewish immigrants, Yiddish-speaking, religious, and he wanted to be an American, like a lot of children of immigrants. He wanted to learn how to be an American and assimilate and not be locked in this very limited world of Yiddish-speaking religious immigrants who worked in the garment business, which his father did and most of the people he knew. And baseball was his way out.
Yet he embraced some of that heritage. Do you think it was because of the anti-Semitism experienced on the field? Whether he wanted it or not, just like the title of your book claims, he's the hero who didn't want to be one.
Yeah, he didn't want to be, you know, this symbol for Jews. He didn't want to be the Jewish baseball player. He just wanted to be a baseball player. But he was playing in the most anti-Semitic period in American history and was a very high-profile Jew, very famous, and had to face anti-Semites in a very public way almost every day. And, you know, he had to figure out how to do that in some sort of a graceful and appropriate way. You know, one of the great questions of life is, what do you do? How are you supposed to act when you're confronted by bigots, especially if tens of thousands of people are watching you? And so, he, you know, had to come up with answers for this and for the situation. And so he became very important to Jews, but he never had wanted to be, you know, a spokesman for the Jews or anything like that.
Well, I have to bring up one incident that took place near here, playing a minor league game in Decatur. He punched a third baseman after dealing with some of those taunts.
Yeah, early in his career, I mean, it was kind of his first reaction. He didn't confront a lot of this growing up in the Bronx. He lived in this very Jewish world. And when he started confronting it, he was just so much bigger than everybody else. He was 6'4" in a generation when most baseball players were under 6 feet. He was just a giant. There were famous pictures of him in all-star teams where everybody is, you know, coming up to the D in Detroit on his shirt. And so, you know, his first reaction was to respond with violence. But he quickly found out that that kind of upstaged everything, you know. Then they wouldn't write about the game, they'd write about the fight, and it wasn't good for the team, and it wasn't good for him. So he had to figure out another way to do it. Then for a while, and this kind of lingers, there was the temptation to settle in private later, follow them into the locker room. He was just so intimidating because of his size, he could just stare at you. I mean, he silenced an entire Yankees bench once just by going over there and staring at them. But eventually he came to learn that the best thing you could do was ignore them, that they really weren't worth it. And he kind of had this epiphany in his last season when he was traded to Pittsburgh and was playing the Brooklyn Dodgers. And it was Jackie Robinson's rookie year. And the bigots were on his team shouting at Robinson. And, you know, Robinson was a superb player, and the Dodgers were this great team, and the Pirates that year were a horrible team. These players weren't very good. And, you know, he just thought about how, you know, these people are losers. They're just not worthy of a response.
Why had anti-Semitism built up so much in Detroit? Why did it become this place that was, I guess, ultimately a good place for him to be and teaching some lessons?
Yeah, Louis Brandeis, who knew America well, Supreme Court Justice, traveled around a lot, and he said in the 1930s that he thought Detroit was the most anti-Semitic town. There were a number of reasons, but, you know, one of the big reasons was that one of the important people in the economy and life of that city was Henry Ford, who was a complete bigot, just a real Jew hater, and owned a newspaper, a weekly, in which, you know, every week he did diatribes against the Jews. And then there was Father Coughlin, who was a Catholic priest who had a radio program that became very popular nationally, in which he railed against the Jews. And having these two nationally famous anti-Semites in this town, you know, probably did a lot to kind of foster this atmosphere.
Let's talk about his, maybe one of the biggest moments as a result of his faith. I mean, playing on Rosh Hashanah and not on Yom Kippur.
Yeah, you know, he probably hadn't thought about it a lot. First of all, it didn't come up a lot. It still doesn't, you know, the high holidays don't fall in the baseball season that often. And then when it was 154 games, much less often. But it did come up in 1934. You know, he probably wouldn't have given it much thought because he never observed high holidays. He really didn't like religion and had no religious observation whatsoever. But the press started talking about it, and it became this huge thing in the press. Will Hank Greenberg play on Rosh Hashanah? And they were in a tight pennant race. They really needed him, and there was just no way he was going to let the team down. I mean, that was his priority. So he did play in Rosh Hashanah against the Boston Red Sox and beat them by 2 runs, which were both home runs by him. So there was all this stuff in the press about Hank Greenberg's home run was like the blow of the shofar. Detroit paper ran in Hebrew print, Lashana Tova, Hank, Happy New Year, Hank. Kind of amazes me that in 1934 a Detroit paper had that font, but apparently they did. And, you know, it was this huge thing. And then Yom Kippur was going to come up 10 days later, and he had to decide what to do. And, you know, he was really having trouble deciding, and what really sealed the deal was that the New York Times went out to the Bronx to interview his parents, and his father said, oh, my boy would never play on Yom Kippur. And he thought, oh, God, what do I do now? And they had not clinched the pennant at that point, but they pretty much had it in the bag and could afford to lose that game. It wasn't a critical game, so he sat it out and went to synagogue. As far as I can find out, the only time in his adult life that he ever went to synagogue for Yom Kippur. And it became this huge thing about how Hank Greenberg respects the high holidays and won't play on them. And the following year, Yom Kippur fell during the World Series, and the Tigers were in the series, and there was no way he was not going to play in the series. He was suited up, ready to go, but he broke his wrist and went on the DL list and couldn't play. And from those two incidents came this enduring myth that Hank Greenberg was a religious Jew, that he observed holidays, that he would never play on high holidays, and he used to roar with laughter about this because, you know, it just wasn't who he was at all. I mean, he didn't even send his kids to Hebrew school. He gave them no religious training at all. He really was not into religion. Late in his life, he was asked in an interview what his Jewish identity was, and he said, well, really, it's an accident of birth, isn't it?
Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert spoke with Mark Kurlansky about his book, Hank Greenberg, The Hero Who Didn't Want to Be One. The book is published by the Yale University Press. A trailer for the 1998 documentary film, The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg, can be found through our website, will.illinois.edu.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 5th of July, 2011. 1937, on this day, Hormel Foods introduced Spam to America, pre-cooked pork and ham in a can with an aspic gelatin holding it together, originally called Hormel Spiced Ham. And it's assumed that the name Spam stands for spiced meat and ham. Though in Britain during World War II, they called it specially processed American meat or supply pressed American meat. And some people suggested it stood for something posing as meat or spare parts animal meat. And somehow it came to stand also for unsolicited, unwanted bulk email advertising. 1946, on this day, the bikini was introduced in Paris, designed by Louis Rayard, who hired an exotic dancer from the Casino de Paris to model it, and said in his advertisements that a swimsuit wasn't really a bikini unless you could pass it through a wedding ring. The brief two-piece swimsuit dates